That starts the recording. There we go. All right.
Okay, so I'll be leading today. Welcome, everyone. Let's do some quick introductions and the welcome I just gave you all. I can move us around the room. Kat.
Pat Todgear, Council Staff.
Thank you, Kat. I'm Richard Sullivan, Council Co-Chair. Stephen.
Steven Spano, the HCAP staff attorney at the A's Legal Referral Bureau.
All right, Stephen. Derek.
Derek Mapp, council member, and this subcommittee's co-chair.
Thank you, Derek. Mark.
Mark Molnar, Council Staff.
Thank you, TJ.
TJ Lee Miyake, council member.
Welcome, Maria.
Maria Lacayo, HIV Health Services.
Ed Chitty.
Council member.
Laura.
Laura Thomas, council member.
Welcome. Last but certainly not least, Kara.
Kara, council staff.
Welcome, everyone. So if we could, let's throw up today's agenda, September 4th for a review and approval. Looks like our usual meeting today, except we will have a resource allocation. Then we have the COLAs, HCAP from Stephen. Anyone see anything they'd like to comment on? Okay, with none, that's approved. Let's take a look at last August 7th minutes, please.
This is a pretty short and straightforward meeting.
Anyone have anything to add or amend? Okay, seeing none, that last month's minutes are approved. So we move on to announcements.
I should probably just let people know I forgot the last committee meeting that this month's meeting is the prioritization allocation meeting. It's no longer really a summit since it's no longer over the course of 2 days or 6 hours, depending on the era. It's still going to be a plus size meeting. So I'd say about maybe 3 hours, perhaps. I'll try to get it to as close to our normal time of 2.5 hours, but I think it'll probably be more like three because we have not only like two full presentations, but we have, of course, resource allocation and prioritization.
Thank you, Mark. Any other announcements?
Hey, Mark, when do we have to get the prioritization form back to you?
This week.
Okay, thank you.
I see no public comment. So, Mark, I believe maybe Kira or Kat, I turn this over to you for resource allocation.
All right. looks like we're all old hands here, so I don't actually need to go over what resource allocation is. Yay. Just a reminder that we use what I call a traveling motion process so that the motions are for resource allocation are generated at the first committee of the month, and then they travel through each committee. And then on to steering, and then from steering to the full council, so that hopefully all committees and as many council members as possible have had eyes on the resource allocation scenarios and have been able to contribute within small group discussions so that this is a more equitable process. So with that said, any questions about resource allocation before we commence? All right, so I'm going to be bringing forward the allocations that were put together for increased, flat, and decreased fundings at yesterday's Council Affairs Committee meeting. These are coming from committee, a committee that achieved quorum, so they're on the floor. They will not need to be moved or seconded, but they are certainly open to discussion, update, change, however you all see fit. Can you all see that? So you'll see a striked out section, and that's because they used as a template the approved scenarios from last year. So that strikeout with an increased funding was a strikeout of last year's scenario and was updated below. Let's start with the most unlikely of the scenarios, which is flat funding. That, of course, would mean that we'd have to receive exactly the same amount as we received last year, which I don't know if that's actually ever happened. So the scenario on the floor is if funding remains at the current level, service category resource allocation will remain level across all categories. With that motion on the floor, any discussion of this motion? Seems pretty straightforward. All right, now we'll do a roll call vote. TJ.
Yes.
Laura.
Yes.
Ed. Ed. Ed Chitty.
You're muted, Ed. Chitty. Ed.
You're muted.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Derek?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes.
All right. This passes, and we'll move on to membership tomorrow. We'll go next to increased funding. Increased funding has happened, although very, very rarely. The last time it happened was actually during the beginning of the COVID pandemic, and may rest at the foot of all of the different things happening around COVID at that time. It is unlikely, but it could happen. So you'll see here, this is where the strikeout is and where this allocation motion was updated. The logic behind the update was so that it could actually parallel the decreased funding motion. So we're going to take a quick detour into decreased without actually voting on it to explain this change. So the decreased funding is... the logic is contingent on the idea that if there is a decrease in funding, that the decreases should first occur, for the first 10% at least, to those service categories that can actually still find other sources of payment, of remuneration, from California's essential health benefits package. And that logic is, of course, around we don't want... those service categories that cannot get paid through the essential health benefits package to take a hit that other categories would not necessarily take. So, for example, if there is a decrease in funding for primary medical care, that doesn't mean that the clinic or hospital will not get paid. They'll simply bill another funding source. This wouldn't be the case for, say, legal services, who are... would not be able to bill for that same service. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so let's go back to increased funding. The change here was to mirror that. And so in some ways it does the opposite. So if increased funding occurs, service category resource allocation will be increased proportionally across all service categories not covered under California's essential health benefits package. So that means, of course, if there's additional money, it will actually go to those service categories that do not fall under essential health benefits. HHS was present at this decision and noted that this would certainly make it more efficient and easier for HHS, because that would mean less contracts would be opened. It was there certainly was a portrait portrayed of how challenging it might be for a small increase to literally open up all service categories and therefore all contracts for all of the different agencies and provide an incremental or small amount of an increase. And some agencies might not even bother to accept it. So, of course, HHS did not weigh in about whether they agreed or disagreed with this motion, but they did say, yes, this would actually make things easier, more efficient, as well as staying and keeping with the decreased funding scenario. All right, I think I explained that as it was discussed. Any questions or discussion about this motion on the floor?
Makes sense to me.
All right, it's on the floor, so it doesn't need to be moved and seconded. Let's go to a roll call vote. Richard.
Yes.
Derek.
Yes.
Ed.
Yes.
Laura.
Yes.
TJ.
Yes.
Thomas.
Abstain.
All right, now we go to the most likely scenario, which is unfortunately decreased funding. This is something that we have faced continually over the years. Fortunately, we do exist within a city that has made up a lot of the decreases, maybe all the decreases, through advocacy from our various service provider networks. So even though we do receive decreases, just as a side note, that hasn't necessarily impacted the system of care, at least in the past 5-6 years. Certainly in the further past, decreases have definitely impacted the system of care and have wiped out entire service categories. So the motion reads, in the event of decreased funding for the first 10% of reductions, allocation for services that are covered under California's Essential Health Benefits Package, and you'll see the note below, which are all of the specific service categories, they will be reduced proportionally. If further reduced allocation is required, i.e. above 10% reduction, reductions will occur proportionally across all service categories. So again, as I mentioned earlier, the logic here is that if there's a cut of up to 10%, then the cuts will go to those categories that can actually get paid elsewhere so that the cuts become in some ways, hopefully, invisible to those agencies. However, if the cut is above 10%, then it's definitely a share the pain equally mode that the council has put forward. Should also keep in mind that if there are deep cuts, the council always has the ability to reconvene and therefore reallocate and essentially changing their decision. So even though this is a motion that will be voted on this month's meeting, reallocation does exist. All right. So any discussion or question of the decreased funding motion that's now on the floor? Well, my time with you all will be very short today. Let's go random. Ed.
A painful yes.
Thomas.
Abstain.
Richard.
Yes.
Laura.
Yes.
TJ.
Yes.
Derek.
Yes.
All right, these allocation scenarios will now move forward to tomorrow's membership committee meeting, and then we'll come to steering committee week after next, and then to the full council. Thank you all, and I'll see you all at whichever meeting I see you next at. Bye.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, moving right along. Welcome back, Stephen Spanos, HCAP report.
Thank you. I do want to thank you all for your patience and flexibility with regard to my absences over the last couple of months. At least one of them was unexpected, so I apologize for that and for affecting whatever effect it had on the agenda. So I did send out reports for June and July last month, even though I was absent. Did the same thing. I sent a combined report for both of those for June and July. Today I sent out to the August report. I'm not sure. Did you receive both of them, Kat? Are you able to throw up? There was some. Questions about the previous, well, not questions, but I think there was interest in me going over the June and July report. So I'll start with that. Can you take that down, actually? Thank you. Let me instead talk about these. Let me send you a different report, actually. Am I able to share?
Yes, screen? You can share.
Let's do that. can I ask you to delete those reports for me?
Yeah, I'll do that. Both of them?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry, I had those mislabeled and that created a problem.
While we wait, Stephen. Oh, just kidding. Never mind.
Sorry about that. So y'all can see the screen here.
Can you can you enlarge it?
Enlarge it, please. Yeah.
aging eyes.
How's that? Is that too big? I can't see what it is that's being shared. I can only see.
That is much better. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Sorry about that. So the first I don't have too much to go over. And as you know, these reports are snapshots in time. So they don't always, indicate where things are anyway. So I thought it might be helpful to just point out some of the things that I normally point out. The first is, and some of these have updates on the most recent report as well. But I'll start with here on page 2. With 2024-10. This is an instance where the where a combination of support services can help a client work through a legal issue. So this is an issue where a client was defending an unlawful detainer action. Despite the support that we have here at AORP, it's not always possible to get everything we need. Clients, oftentimes, if we're going to file reasonable accommodations on their behalves, we need to have a service provider. Oftentimes, clients have trouble accessing care or making their appointments. And when you're talking about an unlawful detainer action, where the turnaround times for documents and answers and responses and discovery is very, very speedy, oftentimes 5 days, we must have some support. This is an instance where, I personally went with a client to connect them to a primary care provider because they'd fallen out of care. We needed to have the client, one, have access to medication because that was going to help them stabilize, two, have access to a medical case manager that could help us, in gathering documents that we would need to effectively support them in the unlawful detainer action. And this I just thought was really important to kind of, obviously I'm not going to talk specifically about the service provider, but what I will say is, this is one of those low barrier services low barrier access to service providers that made a great deal of difference for the client. On this report is the last that you will, that we'll see of this in this particular case for the client. And that's because the client's unlawful detainer was successfully defended. The client remains connected to their primary care provider and medical case management. And I'm told that they are, they've been engaging in a very healthy way. So a success story for low barrier access care. I also will talk about, 2024-42. Hey. This is a case where, again, another housing related case. So we have a client who And this is all very complicated because we have a client that was issued a housing choice voucher, which is a really great voucher. It stays with the client, it's tenant-based, so they can move from unit to unit, and it will stay with them. The problems with it are kind of numerous. The first problem is that it has to be activated within, typically it's about 90 days. Well, it can be up to 6 months, but you know, with extensions to activate the voucher, which means they have to, within that period of time, find a unit, apply for the unit, be accepted for the unit. There's also a process that has to happen between the housing authority and the landlord, and it also must comport with a myriad number of requirements for the voucher. So it can't be, it has to be exactly the same size. You can't, even if you want a smaller unit, if the voucher says you need a one bedroom, you can't get a studio, even if that's the one you want. There's a lot of regulation around it in order to make sure the voucher is activated properly. And that can pose a lot of issues for clients. One, because you know, the paperwork that you get is essentially, it's like a 120-page document that the housing authority hands you with no support available, right? So it's the housing authority basically is reliant upon the service providers. Well, in their minds, they are reliant on the client to manage this on their own. In reality, you know, it falls on service providers who may or may not have the expertise to kind of go through the process to learn it. So a lot came from this client, and we're also kind of in the process of attaining what I hope is going to be a very good result for them. First, it required the coordination of me, some additional legal services, and medical case management to kind of get the client on the same page and get in a room with somebody from the housing authority. So I was kind of although the client was self-advocating, I was advocating with the mayor's office, the housing authority, and finally got everybody in a room to kind of come to, you know, onto the same page to understand what is everybody's role and who is expecting support. In the meantime, we as a system of care also found some additional support for housing navigation. And so that being funded, this is like kind of a new resource that this client has access to. So now, and you know, this will lead me to skip over it on the next report. The reason being is now I've been able to outsource that level of support to this new provider, which is a huge benefit to the client. This is a client who is also in some pretty dire current living situations. Their current unit is awful. Their health is deteriorating. Their landlord is asking them to move back and forth from unit to unit while things are cleaned up, even though things are not getting cleaned up. It's incredibly stressful for the client, all while this deadline of having to activate the voucher is breathing down their neck. And so, you know, I just wanted to kind of tout, this is like a real success for our community's advocacy in obtaining a housing navigator or housing navigation services for clients to be able to kind of navigate this labyrinthian system. Incredibly helpful to just be able to deal with landlords, know when to loop in legal services for reasonable accommodations. You know, these are all things that a client really would not be able to handle. I wouldn't know how to begin with it. Even if it, you know, if it was just me, I would be learning from the very beginning. You know, if it was me with a voucher, and for somebody who's dealing with a number of disabilities, very, very challenging process. So another really awesome success for the system of care. I wanted to share also, let's see. So this is an instance, you know, that it's kind of unfortunate, but I think it's important for folks to understand the trajectory of how HCAP supports and when the support kind of cuts off. And, you know, not that I'm declining to support the client, but in this instance, with 2024-02, I have been supporting this client for a long time. They've been on the report for various, you know, for various reasons over the last 4 or 5 years. They are currently living in a facility that is managed by the service provider, and there has been some ongoing mediation around behavioral things, various disagreements between staff members and the client. The client does struggle with a number of disabilities, has also experienced a significant level of discrimination in their life. Regardless of the, you know, the true reality, right? We've kind of gotten to the point where the service provider has looped in their own counsel. And at that point, my mediation services become kind of moot, right? At that point, once you have a lawyer on the other side, first of all, it would be unethical for me to communicate with the service provider knowing that they're represented by counsel. And second, it's asking for mediation that is not court ordered while there is potential litigation on the horizon makes it a very difficult sell. Oftentimes that indicates that the client is going to move towards an unlawful detainer. At that point, it's up to the judge to order mediation or a mandatory settlement conference, and the client must be supported by legal counsel at that point. So making my rendering my services kind of, for lack of a better word, impotent. You know, I thought it was an important case to highlight just to show the trajectory that a case can go, you know, take. We supported this client, kept them housed for a very long time. I suspect we will continue to do that, but it will be legal services doing it, not HCAP. So I will stop sharing this for a moment to ask, are there any questions that folks have about the cases that I discussed or anything else for that matter?
Hi, Stephen, this is Derek.
Hey, Derek. And
I do have just a more clarifying question, because I think you've answered it in the past. And I ask it because I feel that as time moves along, like there's going to be more of these sort of cases if you're not already seeing them. And that is clients that are having an issue with non-Ryan White providers or entities that at the same time potentially will affect their stability and other sort of Ryan White services or just the stability of their life. And I get the feeling that you actually still do operate on the idea of, you were just talking about cutoff, but just the idea of not necessarily cutting people off, but trying to work between, the services that you can do and, the services that you can refer someone to that's more appropriate for a non-Ryan White situation. Is that correct? Am I making any sense?
Well, I maybe I could benefit from a rephrasing of the question but I mean what I'll say is if my services are not rendered kind of useless by a legal process, I will always offer them, right? But it is difficult to have, you know, mediation is a voluntary process. And so it requires that both parties come to the table with an open heart and open mind to try and resolve the conflict in a way that works for both parties. Filing a lawsuit is inapposite to that consent and that voluntary process. So in this instance, at least the one that I just mentioned, that was the kicker for me. There is
I have another example on this month's report that maybe might be a better example, because it does involve a service provider that is not HIV, that is not funded through HHS, but it came to me through their psychosocial supporter, because that person was concerned about how it was going to affect the person's stability. And in instances like that, I would rather utilize the client's wraparound supports to their benefit, accompany them, you know, and in this instance, I met with both the provider, the service provider, and the client. We talked about, you know, what was going on and how they were feeling and how that was affecting, you know, other things in their life. And, you know, when I, although it's not necessarily in my purview to file a grievance against a non-HIV service provider, I will often support a client through that process regardless. And in this instance, when we do come to that meeting, I will be there. The client's care navigator will be there, and the client will be there, along with this other non-HIV service provider who is, you know, so it kind of depends, but did that at all touch on your question? Does that help? I'm sorry, you're muted.
Actually, it does, and it answered it with clarity. You fell into it naturally, so thank you for that.
So it is important to understand. So despite the fact that with my services, I explicitly do not provide legal services within HCAP. One of the reasons for that is when I know a client, as a member of the California Bar, I'm still beholden to the rules that govern attorneys in California. And one of those rules states that an attorney cannot talk to a represented party in a conflict or in litigation. The reason for that is the law kind of acknowledges that lawyers are trained bullies, and they don't want an attorney going behind the back of another attorney to talk to their client to say, hey, you don't need to talk to your attorney. We'll handle this on our own, right? And because that would be underhanded, that would be sneaky. And it, you know, and I would want, you know, despite me wanting the best outcome for my client, I wouldn't want to do anything kind of nefarious like that. And not only that, but I don't want to lose my law license. And I also think an action like that might thwart my credibility with providers. So I have no problem honoring that ethical code. But that is a very clear barrier for me. There are other less clear barriers that are not necessarily touched on by the professional rules of conduct. But I always err on the side of, propriety, or I try to at least.
Well, and just to let you know where I'm coming from with that, I think as we go along, I think, and you're already seeing it because you've talked about it in your report, several reports now, and that is that housing is getting to be a greater and greater issue of stability and instability for folks with HIV positive in the city and county of San Francisco and outside of it. A number of housing situations that are becoming unstable for folks are not receiving public dollars, right? Like these are more regular sort of apartment settings and this sort of thing, and it remains unclear in my head sometimes about where your services stops and where other providers should be able to pick up.
Well, so the easy answer to that is
I provide services to consumers of HIV-related services who are having trouble accessing those services. So where a housing provider does receive HIV-related funding, that is clearly within the scope of something I can try to work in. Where a housing provider, let's say, you know, for example, as Manuel has discussed, right, there, we have in our system of care RCFCIs. In instances like that, the an RCFCI oftentimes will have multiple parties involved. There's the owner of the building. There is the building manager, which could be, you know, some labyrinth company like Mercy Housing or something like that, John Stewart. And then oftentimes there will be some level of supportive services provided by one of the HIV service providers. That's the only place where it gets a little tricky, because sometimes those things are co-managed. Sometimes there's not a clear delineation of roles between the management company and the HIV service provider, which is something I always advocate for. What I say is, if you're talking about the client about their care, there's no reason for their landlord to be there. You don't need your building manager there to talk to you about your healthcare, right? That is not always the case. Oftentimes these people share office space or, right? And so I'm always trying to advocate for appropriate boundaries between a client's service provider and their building management in instances like that. It's not always a very clear line. But, you know, my services are very explicitly limited to consumers who are receiving or trying to access or accessing HIV-related services that are funded by HHS and the Ryan White Care Program within our EMA. I do not report on them, but it is not unusual for me to speak with folks outside of the EMA who have similar, you know, similar kind of age cap-ish, I call them age cap-ish issues, because nobody else in our office at AORP will know what to do. But I know how to handle that. And I can oftentimes guide the client through that process, even if I can't do all of the normal work I would do on it. But I regularly do step outside that scope to try and provide some level to support with folks, because they're, to my knowledge, there's nobody else that will do it. What I do is I bend the rules in favor of providing services to folks and providing some assistance to folks, even if it's just providing guidance or giving them a list of additional resources that I know of. And I think that benefits the clients within our EMA as well. The only other, because my network becomes broader. That being said, the only other service category of folks, or the only other folks that I can provide services to under the contract, are service providers who receive HIV-related funding. And that happens much less often, where a service provider will come to me and ask me to review their grievance procedure or review their confidentiality procedure. I will oftentimes get technical questions from service providers, and where it doesn't pose a conflict of interest, I'm always happy to entertain that. Or, you know, but I'm always clear with service providers that it's a potential conflict and that I might need to cut that call short or refer them elsewhere or tell them that, you know, they should seek legal counsel elsewhere. But that happens very rarely where those calls come through. But those are the two very clear things that I can provide services to. I don't know if that helps you understand where my services begin and end. But to the extent that there's a difference between an HCAP issue and a legal issue, really what it comes down to is this a case that's in front of a court or could potentially wind up in front of a court or is clearly heading towards a court, right? That's a legal issue. Is this a situation where folks aren't getting along and a little bit of massaging and a little bit of conflict resolution can support? Is it more of a customer service related issue? That's kind of where I sit, you know, to try and avoid the legal issue, because it can certainly escalate to that.
Thank you, Stephen. Anything else, Derek?
No, I was about to thank Stephen as well. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Derek. Stephen, are you going to continue your report or are you done? Just
I think I mostly touched on the cases that I wanted to chat with. What I will do is I'll just share this very quickly. So this is this month's report. I'm speaking about the second one here, 2024-59, the first one. And this is an issue where the client, a blind man, was referred by their psychosocial support service provider. And this is another one of those instances where the psychosocial support service provider they have a therapeutic relationship with them. They have confided in them about these instances. And it would be helpful to have that support with them when we meet with this other non-HIV service provider. So I've tried to do my best in this to make sure that folks know this is not an issue with their psychosocial support service. It was just a referral from their psychosocial support service. And we are more case conferencing and coordinating care with each other to better support the client. So I think that touches upon what we were kind of chatting about just a moment ago, Derek. I did also want to just break down here 2024-60. This is an issue where a client has, and this is an important one, I think, because it's something that it occurs from time to time, but this is an issue where, all right, so the client is employed. They have an income. They also have a housing subsidy, and the housing subsidy has largely enabled them to get to this point where they're employed. They have other stabilities in their life. Their employer, however, does not provide health insurance. And so they pay out of pocket for health insurance, and they may pay more than what they normally, you know, what they could pay. They could probably find, you know, cheaper health insurance, but they like their provider, didn't want to switch healthcare. And so, you know, here they are. Well, what they didn't realize and what they didn't know was their subsidy was decreasing as their income was going up. But what they didn't realize was that their medical expenses are deductible as income. And so I'm now working with the service provider to recalculate their subsidy. I think this is important because this person is in this gap that exists in our system of care, where there's very little guidance and support for folks who are, it's a very clear cut case for somebody who is, let's say, on Social Security, you know, Social Security disability. You get your income verification statement, you submit it once a year, and then you recertify, and that's it. It is less clear if, let's say, you're employed, even if underemployed, and your income is kind of fluctuating from time to time. But, you know, this is a person who has significant earning potential still. They can be in this system of care for a very long time and potentially paying into the systems that are currently supporting them. But there's very little guidance for them on how to get over that little hurdle to kind of pull themselves out of, you know, poverty. And it's not somebody who is on disability. It's on somebody who still has they're a young person. They still have quite a bit of earning potential ahead of them. So there's very little support and guidance for folks in instances like that. But I wanted to point this out because it has been a discussion over the last couple of years in advocating. When folks are trying to pull money from ADAP, from the ADAP program, which, you know, funds OAHIP, these are programs that a lot of folks could utilize to kind of get over that hurdle if their eligibility is met. But the eligibility seems to somehow always just barely miss. And it's kind of a shame. Anyway, those are the big cases that I wanted to talk about. And I feel like I've taken quite a bit of time, which is unusual, but I will ask if there's any further questions. And then I'll put the mic down.
Anything for Stephen? Nope. Well, welcome back and thank you for robust HCAP.
Thank you as always, Stephen, for all of the time and energy and compassion and patience and all the work that you do. I just, every time you give these reports, I'm I'm so glad that you're a part of what we can offer people in San Francisco to help them navigate all of the ways in which we make life very difficult for people dealing with all the intersections of HIV and mental health and housing and everything else. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thanks for the opportunity to support. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Stephen. Okay, everyone, I think we're going to move what? Kira, needs assessment and caller update? Take it away,
yeah,
Kira.
Yeah, just a quick update. So we're currently working to hopefully get, in terms of the needs assessment, we're working to get hopefully one more focus group executed with the Rafiki Coalition. It has been touch and go, but we're really trying to get that to happen. Besides that, we're still recruiting and doing outreach for that. But right now we have a total of 29 participants. So it's not too bad of a number, but we would ideally want more. And then, so because of that, we are now working, we're gonna start doing outreach efforts for the COLA, which if everyone remembers is youth. So outreach efforts will begin. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Kira. Is Kira, there anything to keep? Yeah, Thomas.
Sorry, Kira, how are we defining youth? What's the age?
Oh my gosh, I have it, I believe, right here. I believe it's 19 to 24. I have to look at the demographic report really quick.
No worries, just more curious.
1 second. Yeah, I believe it's 18 to 24, it should be. Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. It isn't 29?
No, I have it as 24, but I can double check with Mark just in case.
Okay, because a couple of years ago, I'm not sure which agency was, they said, like what federal agency said, it was to 29, which we all laughed about because thinking of a 29-year-old as a youth.
DJ, in my experience, the older I get, the higher that number goes, like what I define as youth.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm just asking because I'm also trying to recruit members from the public health program at San Francisco State, so I want to make sure I'm giving the right age.
Yeah, I can, I'm pretty sure it's 18 to 24, but I can double check with Mark just to make sure.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then. I believe that's it for today's meeting. So our next community engagement meeting will be on October 2nd via Zoom. Until then, see you in our respective groups. Everyone be well, be safe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.